From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A car bomb in Beirut killed a former Lebanese diplomat with close ties to Washington. Mohammed Shattah, the former ambassador to the U.S. and ex-finance minister, was killed in the explosion, along with his bodyguard and at least three civilians. Authorities said the blast left around 70 people injured. According to one report from Beirut, the death toll is expected to rise as many of the wounded are in critical condition. Shattah was a senior figure in the March 14th movement. He had also served as an advisor to the former Prime Minister Saad Hariri. We have this report from Press TV's Omar Leski speaking with Ali Risk on the ground in Beirut.
Ali, I'll start by asking you what you can tell us about the casualties, why this former minister was targeted, and of course the implications of this bomb explosion.
As we said in the last interview, we have confirmation from medical sources that the former Lebanese finance minister Mohammed Shattah was killed in this explosion. Now, where there are also unconfirmed reports that the current economic minister of economy was also assassinated in this explosion. That has yet to be confirmed, as I said, but we do have such information which has not been confirmed. Mohammed al-Safadi, the current Lebanese Minister of Economy, may have also been assassinated in this explosion. Clearly, as we also discussed before, it is a political attack. It aims to take advantage of the already existing political polarization. Lebanon, you know, we were discussing before how there is a deep, bitter political rivalry which has increased and went to the extremes, especially as a result of the different and divergent views regarding Syria. And so the political atmosphere here was extremely polarized, and now this is set to further intensify the situation. The goal of this was to further create more tension, to stir more tension, to make, for example, March 14 point the fingers at Hezbollah, point the fingers, for example, at Syria. One would expect, unfortunately, that March 14 will probably actually behave in such a way that it would indeed make such accusations, it would buy into such a plan, and so we could be in for deep political rivalry. One might also expect more political assassinations to take place. As I said, we have to recall as well, as I mentioned in the last interview, this person, former minister Mohammed Shattah, is extremely close to the Hariri family, and so attacking him would be considered as an attack on March 14, one of the biggest symbols of March 14. Indeed, actually, if I forgot to mention, he indeed is an advisor of Saad Hariri, of the Hariri family, and has been a long time advisor, for years. And so, you know, this target indeed is a target which carries a lot of symbolic essence, which actually points out to the fact that we are in for some deep infighting here in Lebanon. I think that the main issue to await is how will the Lebanese political factions react. That would probably be the biggest issue. What will the how will the politicians behave? Who will the accusations be pointed at? I would assume, and I hope I'm mistaken, but I would assume that many would say that this is Sayed Hassan following through on his threats, because many March 14 figures have said, for example, that Sayed Hassan issued threats against March 14 in his last speech. And so I would expect that some of these figures would make these accusations at Hezbollah. I do hope that I'm mistaken, but that does appear to where we're headed. And I think another problem is the fact that many politicians here in Lebanon are closely associated with regional countries. March 14, its main regional associate is considered to be Saudi Arabia, and as long as we have the Saudis continuing with their policy in such a way, March 14 will continue with the same policy because of the attachment they have to the Saudis. So Lebanon, I think, remains hostage, as do other countries, remains hostage to some regional policies. policies, to the policies being pursued by some countries. So until this regional situation calms down as a whole, I think Lebanon will remain as such. And the problem which further what further increases the problem is that Lebanon has a weak state. You know, the army doesn't have, barely has a political cover to hunt down the culprits and the perpetrators and the instigators of this violence. And it is indeed a very dark, a very dim situation which we have, whether it be in Lebanon or in Iraq. As we discussed before, this is set to continue at least until January the 22nd, once the Geneva II conference is held. Now, in that perspective, the Geneva II conference, if you recall, if you've noticed over the past few days, many are saying that the priority of Geneva II would be to discuss combating terrorism and not to discuss, you know, whether it's Bashar Assad or whether it's anyone else, which would further, or which has indeed further increased Saudi anger. And so, you know, we're seeing what we see now. This is the result. So it's all put together. We have internal political polarization, instability. Somebody has taken advantage of it by carrying out this attack, which, you know, I anticipate will further divide and will further increase the tense situation in Lebanon. And as long as the regional equation is as such, people will try and take more advantage of these political differences.
Right, Ali, and as you're speaking, we're taking a look at those live pictures, a huge security presence there at the site of the explosion. We did hear, Ali, that this former minister advisor to Saad Hariri, who was unfortunately assassinated in this attack, was in a convoy and he was heading to a meeting of the March 14 alliance at the house of the former prime minister. Is it clear who was with him in the convoy and what that meeting was about?
Yes, indeed. He was targeted. The former finance minister was targeted. His convoy was targeted by an explosion. The meeting was set to discuss, you know, the general political situation inside Lebanon. You know, there are a lot of political developments taking place in Lebanon right now. For example, the issue of forming a government or not forming a government. This was also a topic of Sayyid Hassan's speech. You know, Sayyid Hassan calling for a national unity government. March 14 calling for a neutral government, a non-political government. We have the issue of the presidential term of Michel Suleiman. All of these issues are issues of controversy and disagreement between rival Lebanese political factions, and those issues were set to be the topic of discussion during this meeting, which was set to be held. And so, once again, that might add further to the fact that you know, the side which carried out this attack, you know, planned or aims to create further divisions inside Lebanon to target such a political meeting at such a delicate, sensitive political time. Also shows that this was the main goal. So we do await to see what could take place. But another danger which we must speak of is that these takfiris, or these militants, and this is takfiri style assassinations, or it might be, as I said, Mossad, or maybe both at the same time. We have to recall as well, as we've mentioned, that the Israelis also have a huge benefit in instability inside Lebanon, in keeping, for example, Hezbollah preoccupied in internal situations, internal polarization, internal bickering, and so Israel would also have a huge interest in such an attack. The problem is, if this political bickering continues, if March 14 falls into this trap or goes along with this, that will create more fertile ground for such attacks to take place, because as we all know, the more the political polarization, the more vulnerable the country becomes, and the more fertile ground we have here in Lebanon, which attracts takfiris and also facilitates for anyone, Israel, takfiris or other people, to carry out these attacks and carry out their agendas.
Right, and Ali, the situation in Lebanon, we've been seeing the security situation deteriorating, especially in those areas that had this conflict between supporters and opponents of the Syrian government in Tripoli. You're reporting for us there, but an explosion like this, at this scale, in central Beirut, where the government headquarters are located, where the March 14 Alliance headquarters is located, what does it signify? And a lot of people are now making comparisons to the Rafiq Hariri assassination. Are you also hearing that?
Yes, it could be compared to the Hariri assassination. It actually... is quite symbolic. In comparison, the symbolism is pretty close, although Rafiq Hariri was much more of a higher ranking figure, maybe we could say, in March 14. But I think we also have to mention the fact that other attempts maybe have failed. If you recall, or you just mentioned that, we have had this situation in Tripoli, we've had attacks against Lebanese armies, and now they've resorted to political assassinations. So it might be the fact that after all they've done, whoever they may be, as I said, they is not clear who it is when we refer to they, Israel, Saudi Arabia, the Takfiris themselves, but whoever they may be, the previous plans might not have achieved the goals which they wanted, and so now resorting to the political polarization factor, taking advantage of that card. And what I've also noticed is that the more we see progress, or the more we see signs that the US is changing policy, particularly after the latest remarks, if you recall, for example, Michael Hayden, the former CIA chief, or Ryan Crocker, the former US ambassador to Syria, comments by these people who say that maybe Assad remaining is the best, worst scenario according to their own terms. So as this has comes, Saudi Arabia increases its anger and its frustration and its fears, and takes it out, expresses its anger left, right, and center. For example, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, as I said, these three countries are the main three countries where, many analysts say Saudi Arabia is taking it out, expressing its anger. And we might also, some people point out to what is happening also on the Iranian borders with Pakistan, Balochistan, where Saudi Arabia also has an influence. So the more things become, the more policies or things appear to be going against Saudi Arabia's wishes, the more we'll see escalation. So if indeed we see more progress made in Syria, then I think you're going to see more such attempts taking place here in Lebanon, in Iraq, inside Syria, also maybe trying to stir problems in Iran. That does appear to be the pattern. This is not accusations from the vacuum. That does appear to be the pattern. The more progress being made, the more the US starts to make changes and adjustments to the policy, the more Saudi Arabia expresses fears, and then the more we see this violence taking place, which is targeting, and that's why I always mention Saudi Arabia, it's targeting countries which Saudi Arabia views as it has lost to Iran, Iraq, Syria, and this country here, Lebanon. Yes. So this will probably continue unless we see some sort of a sudden change in Saudi policy, which many people believe up until now is still far off. Even Sayyid Hassan in his last speech mentioned that there is no sign up as of yet that Saudi Arabia plans to change policy. Again, I might want to emphasize these accusations aren't out of vacuum. This is analysis of the general trend of events. This is how it looks like. Saudi Arabia and Israel, if you look at it logically speaking, they are the primary beneficiaries of these explosions.
Thank you very much, Ali Rizk, correspondent, joining us there live from the site of the bomb blast in Beirut, the Lebanese capital. Thank you, Ali.
Although no one has yet claimed responsibility for the attack on Friday, the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah strongly condemned the attack, along with several others that have taken place recently in Beirut. The group said in a statement issued today, quote, "This crime is one of a series of crimes and blasts aimed at devastating the country," closed quote. The statement further denounced the attack as, quote, "a flagrant attempt to target the national stability and unity of Lebanon," closed quote, adding that only the enemies of the country would benefit from such attacks. India is taking a step to retaliate against the United States for its arrest of the Indian UN ambassador, Sanjay Sethi reports from New Delhi.
India has downgraded immunity of U.S. diplomats. This is in response to an arrest of an Indian diplomat in New York. U.S. officials and their families in four consulates in India are affected by the move. New ID cards mentioning the limited immunity have been issued by the Indian Foreign Ministry. These would not protect them if they commit serious offenses. New Delhi has called the step as the one taken in strict reciprocity. Of all the retaliatory measures taken by India, removal of the security barriers has worried the US.
What others get, they get. They are no longer special people here. And that is important for good relations. Very important for good relations. That is the basis on which good relations are made. And this, therefore, will be a new beginning.
Washington has provided similar status to Indian consulate officials in the U.S. With this step, India is hoping to pressurize the U.S. It is demanding a withdrawal of all charges against the diplomat arrested in New York, Devyani Korbagade, who is out on bail. She is facing criminal charges for visa fraud in connection with her maid, who was underpaid according to U.S. laws. India is trying to protect her from future arrest.
They have been also caught wrong-footed. We've been wrong-footed. Both bureaucracies have been wrong-footed. So, you know, but the hurt has gone deep into our public and to our psyche. So whatever U.S. reactions, basically, we have basically said that we've taken a stand. We don't care two bits about your reaction now.
U.S. authorities have also been slow in providing information about names and salaries of Indians working at the embassy and its four consulates as requested by the Indian Ministry of External Affairs.
Analysts say escalating the Indian diplomat maid's issue further will only worsen ties that have come under a lot of strain over the past few days.
The former president of Colombia, Alvaro Uribe, confirmed on Wednesday in his Twitter account his cooperation with the CIA and the U.S. National Security Agency against the leaders of the FARC during his time in office. The collaboration by the Colombian government with the NSA and CIA in operations in which three FARC leaders, Raul Reyes, Jorge Briseño, and Alfonso Caño, were killed, were first reported this past Sunday in the Washington Post. Uribe admitted that the military operations conducted during his 8 years in office from 2002 to 2010 were done with the cooperation of the CIA and the NSA. The CIA reportedly helped place the Colombian military into the jungles of the country through its technology, which helped specify the location of targets. That information was used in operations to capture or kill FARC members. Next month will mark 4 years since at least 100,000 Haitians died when their island was rocked by a massive earthquake. Despite the declarations of solidarity and promise of aid from around the globe, only deeper poverty and more political repression have actually been delivered to the Haitian people. As political and economic conditions there continue to deteriorate under a corrupt, brutal government backed by multinational military units, many of Haiti's people continue to try to find a better life elsewhere. One recent attempt led to the deaths of more than a dozen people Wednesday. Don Bob reports.
The Christmas Day drowning of at least 18 Haitian migrants when their sailboat capsized off the Turks and Caicos Islands has refocused attention on the crisis of desperation migration. According to Ambassador William Swing, Director General of the International Organization for Migration, he offered condolences and deep sympathy to the families of those affected by this terrible incident, but noted, "We must also find ways to stem the root causes bringing people to risk all by taking to the high seas in flimsy craft." The latest deaths occurred when a marine police unit of the Turks and Caicos Islands intercepted an overcrowded fishing sloop and was towing it to shore. The Haitian vessel capsized as it approached land, leading to a frantic pre-dawn search and rescue attempt by the police. A 10-year-old child remains unaccounted for after authorities rescued 32 migrants and recovered the bodies of 18 Haitians in crystal clear water, only 150 meters from land. Ambassador Swing said the tragedy underscores the urgency of the international community taking decisive action to address the causes of what can only be described as desperation migration. The tragedy pushes the global number of migrants who've died this year while attempting to cross a border and find a new life to a record 2,378, according to IOM figures. The agency said this number is conservative and does not include many unrecorded deaths of African migrants who succumb while crossing the Horn of Africa or Sinai Desert, for example. Don Bob, United Nations.
Okinawa officials approved the long-awaited relocation of the U.S. Marine Corps' Futenma Air Station on Friday, according to Japan's Defense Ministry. The move settled decades of often heated negotiations between Tokyo and Washington. Local officials signed on to a plan that paves the way for the construction of a new American military base on a coastal area within Okinawa Prefecture. Okinawa's population is angered with the decision, and reports emerged that crowds were gathering to protest. Tomoko Kamata from Japan's NHK World reports from Okinawa.
Governor Hirokazu Nakaima had been one of the main opponents of relocating the U.S. Futenma Air Station. He'd be demanding the base be moved out of Okinawa.
We have decided that the project complies with environmental protection measures and meets the relevant standards. So, we decided to approve the Japanese government's proposal.
The U.S. military built Futenma in 1945 in the city of Ginowan. About 4,000 Marines live there. But its urban location has been a source of friction. Locals bring up past accidents when they complain about the risks they face. And they're quick to point out that base personnel have committed crimes. In 1996, Japanese and the U.S. leaders agreed to relocate Futenma. Many locals hoped they would move it out of Okinawa. They insist other parts of Japan should shoulder more of the burden of hosting military facilities. But the two governments agreed to shift the base to the city of Nago. They decided to reclaim coastal land to build new runways. According to law, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe needed Governor Nakajima's approval to start dumping rocks and dirt into the Pacific Ocean. So he tried to work out a deal. Abe promised to allocate around $3,000 million per year for the next 8 years to boost Okinawa's economy. And he said he'd try to cut in half the number of drills by a controversial U.S. aircraft, the Osprey. The prime minister also pledged to start negotiations with the U.S. to speed up the process of closing Futenma.
The people of Okinawa continue to experience a heavy burden. That should also be shared with the people on the mainland of Japan.
The government's plan for Okinawa's promotion includes most of our requests. I feel the Abe cabinet is thinking more about Okinawa than any other administration in the past.
People in Okinawa have listened to talk about Futenma's future for years. The final decision has left them divided.
I'm for the plan. Residents here can live in safety and peace.
In the end, I knew this was going to happen. It's a real shame. I guess the government always has the power to decide.
Defense Ministry officials say they will start preparing for construction. But the road ahead doesn't appear smooth. Opposition to the relocation remains strong. The central government has yet to work on a roadmap for the closure of Futenma, nor has it figured out how to eliminate safety risks for residents living near the new base. Tomoko Kamata, NHK World.
Though Okinawa's governor, Hirokazu Nakajima, was originally against the deal to keep the base in his jurisdiction, a meeting held Wednesday with the Japanese prime minister proved pivotal, apparently. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe reportedly pledged a healthy annual sum of cash into Okinawa's economy until 2021. The deal could still face legal challenges and protests based on stiff public opposition to the airbase staying in Okinawa. The estimated cost of the relocation is about $8.6 billion, with Japan set to cover $3.1 billion of that amount. A federal judge in New York Friday ruled that the National Security Agency's program of systematically keeping phone records of all Americans is lawful, creating a conflict among lower federal courts and increasing the likelihood that the issue will be resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court. In today's ruling, Judge William H. Pauley III of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York granted a motion filed by the federal government to dismiss a challenge to the program brought by the ACLU. Judge Pauley said that protections under the Fourth Amendment do not apply to records held by third parties like phone companies. He wrote, quote, "While robust discussions are underway across the nation, in Congress and at the White House, the question for this court is whether the government's bulk telephony metadata program is lawful. This court finds it is," closed quote. That ruling comes nearly 2 weeks after Judge Richard H. Leon of the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia said the program most likely violated the Fourth Amendment. As part of his ruling, Judge Leon ordered the government to stop collecting data on two plaintiffs who brought the case against the government. In his ruling, which was stayed until appeal, Judge Leon said that the program, quote, "infringes on that degree of privacy that the founders enshrined in the Fourth Amendment," close quote, prohibiting unreasonable searches and seizures. As 2013 comes to a close, it's time to take a look back over the past 12 months. One big story was the apparent turnaround in American policy towards Syria after the U.S. claimed the Syrian government had used chemical weapons. Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition spoke with Liberation Radio back in late September.
Well, we could see by what happened since August 21st, when the Western governments reported that chemical weapons had been used by some force. They said the Assad government accused the rebels of staging a provocation. But since that issue came to light on August 21st, it seemed as if the world was going to experience another major U.S.-led direct military intervention or war in another Middle Eastern country. And it was the grassroots movement around the world, particularly in the region of the Middle East, but inside the United States, inside of Europe, indeed everywhere, that temporarily at least stayed the hands of those who are rushing to war. So the organizations that came together in Beirut were the Arab International Forum. Like peace and progressive activists everywhere, felt, okay, what we did, what people in the grassroots did, what our mobilization did, had a palpable impact on the policymakers and on the war makers.
A deal brokered by Russian President Vladimir Putin ended with Syria handing over its chemical weapons to international agencies. That removed the danger of Syria being accused again of crossing the red line declared by President Obama, who said the U.S. would intervene if the Syrian government used chemical agents. Since then, the killing and destruction in Syria have continued, while the U.S. has scrambled to reposition itself with no clear policy yet emerging from Washington. And finally, Dispatches from the Edge gives annual awards for news stories and newsmakers falling under the category of Are You Serious? This year, they gave the Confused Priorities Award to the Associated Press for a March 5th story entitled Little Reaction in Oil Market to Chavez's Death on the Demise of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. The authors noted that Venezuela has the second largest oil reserves in the world after Saudi Arabia, but that the former leftist president had squandered that wealth. The report said, quote, Chavez invested Venezuela's oil wealth into social programs, including state-run food markets, cash benefits for poor families, free health clinics, and education programs. But those gains were meager compared with the spectacular construction projects that oil riches spurred in glittering Middle Eastern cities, including the world's tallest building in Dubai and plans for branches of the Louvre and Guggenheim Museums in Abu Dhabi, close quote. When Chavez won the presidency in 2001, some 70% of the population was considered poor in spite of $30 billion in annual oil revenues. 2% of the population owned 60% of the land, and the gap between rich and poor was one of the worst in Latin America. According to the Gini coefficient that measures wealth, Venezuela now has the lowest rate of inequality in Latin America. Poverty has been reduced to 20% and extreme poverty from 40% to 7.3%. Illiteracy has been virtually eliminated, and infant mortality has dropped from 25 per thousand to 13 per thousand. Health clinics increased 170%, and 5 million Venezuelans receive free food. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.